So now back to the standard kind of chapter in which we survey an organ system in particular. This time the digestive system. And before we get into the anatomy of it, we should just talk about what it does. Now obviously the digestive system has as one of its functions digestion, right? But it's much more than that. That's just part of the overall process of dealing with the food that we eat. That's the main function of the digestive system, right? Very important system. Well, there's no such thing as an unimportant system, except maybe the reproductive system. In terms of you living without it. Not just because I don't like kids. The digestive system is kind of one we don't think about sometimes, but of vital importance. So important, in fact, that, as we'll talk about, it has its own nervous system dedicated to it. But anyway, yes, digestion is one of those functions of the digestive system, but what has to happen before digestion takes place? Right, what is a word for eating? Ingestion, right. Ingestion is a function because that involves parts of the digestive system. And that occurs, of course, at the mouth. What else? What's next in the process of processing that food? Chewing, right. What's the name for that? Mastication, exactly. That's a function of the digestive system. And mastication is part of a bigger function, which is digestion itself. Okay, well, what does digestion just by itself mean? What is it referring to? What is digestion? Right, it's disassembly of food into smaller particles that eventually will be put into the body. I don't think I need to remind you that the food that you put in your mouth is outside of your body and remains outside of your body all the way through that tube, even though we call it, it's only food for a while, then we call it something else, then we call it something else, but it's outside of your body that whole time. Anyway, that's what digestion is. It's breaking things into smaller chunks at the macroscopic level and at the microscopic level. So there are two components to digestion itself. What am I talking about? What kinds of digestion are there? Well, mastication, like I said, accomplishes one of those. What kind? No, not swallowing. That's a function unto itself. Right. Mechanical digestion and chemical digestion. Mastication is mechanical digestion. That's one way that we mechanically digest our food. That means actually breaking it at the macroscopic level into just smaller pieces. Still pieces that are way too big to enter the body. But, you know, when we chew the food, we're making it into a lot smaller and greater number of pieces. Why does that aid the overall digestion process? Because chewing does not break it into the individual molecules, the monomers that the polymers are made out of, which you need to do in order to have it small enough to get into your body. Chewing doesn't accomplish that. But it helps out in the it helps the process of chemical digestion. For what reason? Why does just chewing it into smaller pieces help that? Well, what does chemical digestion require the help of? If you're going to break a polymer into monomers, which is what chemical digestion is, what do you need the help of to break those chemical bonds? Enzymes, right. Digestive enzymes specifically. Digestive enzymes are responsible for chemical digestion. But how does an enzyme in general, whether it's digestive or any other kind of enzyme, how does it operate? It has to do what in order for it to work? It has to bind to the substrate that it's acting on, right? In this case, the substrate is that food that needs to be broken into smaller molecules. Well, there's not going to be a binding of food substrate to a digestive enzyme unless the two encounter each other. So when you break a big food chunk into smaller chunks by chewing, which is mechanical digestion, you're exposing a lot more surface of that food to the enzymes that are present in, first of all, saliva, but then later on, the stomach and the small intestine also contain digestive enzymes. Right? If you think about the surface area to volume ratio slides that I showed explaining why we don't just turn into one huge cell, right? When you compare a cube that has a certain surface area with a bunch of little cubes that add up to the same volume of that big cube, well, there's a lot more surface area on that big number of small cubes, even though the volume hasn't changed. So that's what we do. We by chewing, we make it much more likely for our digestive enzymes to encounter the molecules in the food than they would be if you just swallowed one big chunk. But mastication or chewing is not the only part of mechanical digestion. Mechanical digestion continues in the stomach because of the churning action of the stomach, and also in the small intestine as well. If the contents of the stomach and the small intestine were not churned, once again, there would be a much less likelihood for the enzymes secreted by those organs, stomach and small intestine, to encounter the polymers, the molecular polymers that need to be broken down by those enzymes into the monomers that will be small enough to enter the body. All right, so digestion is another major function, of course, of the digestive system, but that includes mechanical digestion in the form of mastication and also organ churning, and chemical digestion in the form of secretion of digestive enzymes. And those enzymes for chemical digestion are secreted from salivary glands. Saliva is chemical digestion starts in the mouth. Not much of it occurs in the mouth, but specifically starch digestion begins in the mouth, and just a little bit of fat digestion as well. Chemical digestion I'm talking about. More fat digestion occurs in the stomach, along with a gross breakdown of proteins in the stomach. But the bulk of the chemical digestion occurs in the small intestine. That's where your food polymers, you know, the things that all organisms are made of, proteins, polysaccharides, nucleic acids, and fats, among the lipids is the fourth category, but when it comes to eating, most of the lipids by far that you ingest are in the form of fats. All of those get completely broken down by the time the small intestine is involved, so that you have the monomers that those are made out of. And so what are those monomers in the case of proteins? Amino acids. In the case of polysaccharides, monosaccharides. In the case of nucleic acids, nucleotides. And in the case of fats, specifically among lipids, what are the building blocks of fats? What's another name for a fat? What did you say?
I said
triglycerides. Triglycerides is another name for a fat. What's a third name for a fat? A fatty acid is just a part of a fat. Another name, a third name for fat or triglyceride is triacylglycerol. those are the complete molecule, the complete multi-part molecule. That, when it gets digested, gets broken down into its components, which are a glycerol molecule and three fatty acids. Those are then small enough to be put into the body. Now, speaking of putting it into the body, that's the next overall process that the digestive system accomplishes. And what is that process called when it actually enters the body? Absorption, correct. Absorption. And absorption occurs at different places along the way, but most absorption takes place in the small intestine because, like I said, that's where the original food is now in the form of individual monomers small enough to be absorbed. Now, the stuff that does not get absorbed is just residue, meaning the stuff remaining. So that residue, which has never been in your body, never does enter your body. And therefore, it eventually leaves the tube as feces. Right? But all that really is a collection of stuff that did not get digested and therefore didn't get absorbed, plus just a hell of a lot of bacteria. All right? But, like I said earlier, we change the name of what we're talking about, the contents of this tube, depending on where it is. It's food originally. After it's been in the stomach, after you swallow and put that into the stomach, we no longer call it food. What do we call it? What is it? Chyme, C-H-Y-M-E. Chyme, we keep calling it chyme through the stomach and the small intestine. By the time it reaches the large intestine, just about all of the good stuff has been absorbed. The nutrients have been absorbed by that point. And so just the residue remains, and that's when we rename it feces. That doesn't mean, though, that the feces don't undergo any change. So there is yet another function of the digestive system that deals with processing the feces before they leave. What is that called? Remember I talked about drying out the feces, which is a major function of the large intestines? Large intestine. That's part of compaction. Compaction is another major function. So that's mostly because of absorbing water from the still pretty wet feces. Now, not too much water can be taken out, or otherwise you won't get rid of the feces very easily, right? So there has to be some remaining. But that's what the large intestine's all about. And then finally, what is the last process? The last function of the digestive system. Not excretion. Actually, excretion can be added as a list of functions of the digestive system, but it's a minor function. Excretion is mostly the job of the respiratory and urinary systems. Respiratory system, remember that excretion is getting rid of something that was in the body, but that the body does not need. So it's getting rid of waste. Okay? CO2 is a major waste that's in your body. It's in the cells and therefore needs to be excreted. Ex meaning out of. And the urinary system, right, that excretes all kinds of things that are in your body that need to be gotten rid of. Nitrogenous waste and other sorts of things that we talked about. Well, the residue, the stuff that does not get absorbed, which eventually gets renamed feces, never was in your body. So it's not proper to say that it gets excreted. There are some wastes at very low level that actually get excreted into the digestive tract and therefore get eliminated along with the feces. But the feces aren't, that doesn't really represent excretion. So what is the name for getting rid of the feces? Defecation. Notice that that is defecation, defecation. So that's the final major function. Okay, so if we now look at this anatomy in slide one, this continuous tube that runs from the mouth to the anus that I keep talking about, that collectively is known as what? The alimentary canal, correct. Aliment means food or nutriment, and therefore alimentary means of the food. So alimentary canal is one name for it. You could also call it what? It's a phrase you know. Digestive tract, yes. But I mention that because I want to tell you that it's not true that you could also call the alimentary canal the gastrointestinal tract or GI tract. The GI tract is just part of the digestive tract, just part of the alimentary canal. So digestive tract, alimentary canal, those are interchangeable. But gastrointestinal literally means stomach and intestines only, right? Gastric means of the stomach. So gastrointestinal tract leaves off part of the alimentary canal. It includes just the stomach and the two intestines, large and small. Now the alimentary canal, though, which is the entire tube from mouth to anus, that does not include all the organs of the digestive system, though. That just makes up the continuous hollow organs, or set of organs, the entire canal. Attached to that alimentary canal here and there are various accessory organs, as they're called. And so the accessory organs include such things as the tongue, the teeth, the salivary glands, the liver, the pancreas. These are all accessory organs of the digestive system. What makes the difference between them and the alimentary canal is that they don't actually form part of the tube. The accessory organs don't. Most of them are glands that actually empty into the lumen of the alimentary canal, but they don't form the actual tube itself. The alimentary canal, though, does consist of several organs that actually form the tube. So the parts in order of the alimentary canal, and by in order I mean with respect to ingestion first and defecation last. The first part is the mouth or oral cavity. You could also call it the buccal cavity, B-U-C-C-A-L. Buccal means of the cheeks, but buccal cavity is another name for the oral cavity. So that's the very first part of the tube. That leads to what part? What is the where the mouth ends, what that's the beginning of what? Next part. The pharynx or throat, which we've talked about in another chapter, right? Because the pharynx is a common passageway for food, drink, and air. Well, food and drink are included in this chapter. So pharynx is the second part. And then what? Then the esophagus, which notice includes that same phage root as in phagocytosis, cell eating. So esophagus, the tube that extends from the pharynx to the stomach. Now, the esophagus is a thoracic organ, right? It exists in the thorax. What specific part of the thorax? The mediastinum, right. In other words, the chamber between the two lungs, where you find the heart and a bunch of tubing, mostly. It's also where the thymus is, especially when you're young. But that's where the esophagus is. Its entire length is in the thorax. the stomach is in the abdomen. What is the official boundary between the thorax and the abdomen in a human? Diaphragm. So that means for that food to get from the esophagus to the stomach, the esophagus must penetrate the diaphragm, and it does. It doesn't continue as the esophagus very much at all after the diaphragm, so there's just a little bit left before it enters the stomach. The stomach is the next part of the alimentary canal. The stomach then continues on as part of the tube, where it leaves off and the small intestine begins. And the small intestine has different sections to it. Actually, the stomach does too. We'll mention these different sections as we look at the organs in detail. But the small intestine, called small only because of its diameter, is actually much longer. It's the longest part of the tube as a single part. It's much longer than the large intestine, though. The large intestine is called large because it has a larger diameter, but it's shorter in length. The overall length of the alimentary canal, by the way, is much longer than the height of your body. It's about 5 meters long in a living person, and twice as long in a dead person. And that's simply because when the muscles relax, it's not clenched up. It gets much longer. So in a cadaver, you can extend the intestines very, very far. But anyway, the small intestine comes first. It's between the large intestine and the stomach. Or I should say the stomach and the large intestine in terms of flow of materials. And that's where, like I said, most of the digestion and most of the absorption takes place. So that's where the monomers as molecules finally enter the body, most of them. The large intestine also has different parts to it, and we can see them actually labeled here. You don't see the parts of the small intestine labeled here, but the small intestine gives rise to the large intestine at the lower right part of the abdomen. You don't actually see the two join here, but the first part of the large intestine is the cecum, the ascending colon, then the transverse colon, then the descending colon, so named because of the flow of materials through them. This is in a person that isn't reversed, right? This is a normally situated person. These are all part. Colon is another name for large intestine, but cecum, ascending colon, transverse colon, descending colon, rectum, and anus. Well, anal canal and then anus. That's all part of large intestine. So that completes the alimentary canal. You don't get a very good view of the pancreas here, which is a major digestive organ. You can see the liver, and you can see the gallbladder, which I didn't include in the list of accessory organs before, but it is. The liver is the largest gland of the body. Now, it has many more functions than just being a gland, and we've talked about some of those functions. But it's important in the digestive system because it produces bile, the secretory product of that gland. And bile eventually makes its way into the lumen of the alimentary canal to, we'll talk more about bile later, but it is a digestive fluid. But it doesn't go directly from the liver to the small intestine. It first goes to the gallbladder, which stores that bile. Doesn't just store it, though. It actually concentrates it by absorbing water from the bile. So the gallbladder actually modifies the bile, makes it more concentrated, not by adjusting the solutes, but by adjusting the water. Removal of water will make it more concentrated. And then, so the liver more or less continuously makes bile. The gallbladder stores it until it's needed for digestive reasons, and then intermittently will release some of that bile into the alimentary canal. The pancreas releases a lot of digestive enzymes, but the pancreas is an example of an organ that is part of an overlap between organ systems, right? We've already talked about the pancreas in one system. What it's a member of the digestive system, but what else? What other system? Endocrine system, right. It produces hormones and it produces exocrine secretions as well. Endocrine secretions are the hormones. It's an endocrine organ. It also has exocrine secretions. Those are the digestive enzymes that it releases into the alimentary canal. The rest of this we'll look at in greater detail when we go through the whole system. Let's go on to slide 2 and talk about the histology of the alimentary canal. Now, regardless of this happens to be right where the esophagus is penetrating through the diaphragm, but actually it doesn't matter where you are on the alimentary canal, that tube is made up of these major components listed on the left. And from top to bottom, they are listed here from deep to superficial. But remember, deep here, since we're talking about the alimentary canal, deep means toward the food or chyme or feces, right? It's the deepest part of the alimentary canal is the part that's actually in contact with the food. Superficial means away from the lumen. All right. So the deepest major layer of any part of the alimentary canal, like I said, they all have this, not just this part, is the mucosa, which is just another name for a mucous membrane. Mucous membranes are so called because they produce mucus, right? Just remember that the adjective is mucous, like in mucous membrane. The stuff they produce is mucus, mucus. But as you can see by the indentation, the mucosa consists of an epithelial layer. And what that epithelium is actually depends on where you are in the alimentary canal. Most of the length of the alimentary canal is simple columnar epithelium. The beginning of it, mouth and esophagus, or almost all of the esophagus at least, is stratified squamous epithelium. And also the very end, the last part of the anal canal, is also stratified squamous, but the rest of it is simple cuboidal. Now, why would you have the beginning and the end be stratified squamous epithelium? The idea here is that the beginning and the end take the greatest abuse. Abrasive abuse. So they get worn out. They would get worn out if there were just one layer of cells. A stratified epithelium can withstand layers of cells being sloughed off by friction. Just like when your skin, the epidermis of your skin is stratified. So eating, you know, that food is kind of sharp. It is going to remove layers of cells. So you need to have many layers. Same with defecation. It can be abusive to the epithelium. But the rest of it is simple columnar. Simple so that it's as thin as possible so that absorption can happen easily. But columnar because absorption requires a hell of a lot of transport proteins embedded in the membrane, which require a lot of cellular machinery to make, and therefore the cell has to be kind of tall in order to fit all that machinery in it. Anyway, the epithelium, whatever kind it is positioned on another part of the mucosa called lamina propria, which is a kind of a thin layer of connective tissue. And then, also in that same mucosa layer, is muscularis mucosae, which literally means the muscle of the mucosa. So we're talking about what kind of muscle? Smooth muscle, right. And also remember that the smooth muscle and the cardiac muscle are not part of the muscular system. The muscular system is when you learn the three types of muscle, but the muscular system as an organ system includes just the skeletal muscle. Cardiac muscle, of course, is part of the circulatory system, And the smooth muscle is found in various systems, but most of the smooth muscle is in the digestive system as part of the alimentary canal. Okay, so that's the deepest layer. That's in direct contact. Well, the epithelium of the mucosa is in direct contact with the contents of the alimentary canal. Food first, then chyme, and then feces. The next layer, more superficial from that, is the submucosa. And the submucosa is mostly connective tissue, but running through it are various vessels, blood vessels, lymphatic vessels. Also, glands are situated there, glands that empty into the lumen of the alimentary canal, situated in the submucosa. Next layer, working superficially, is muscularis externa. Externa meaning superficial in this case. So obviously there's muscle in the muscularis externa as well. There was already muscle in the mucosa. It's a much thinner layer. By the way, the muscularis mucosae, I forgot to mention what it does when we were back in the mucosa. It gives shape to the epithelium, produces little folds in it, but it can, the position of those folds can change. So this is part of the churning that I was talking about that will help in exposing enzymes to the food particles they need to digest. That's a thinner layer, though, compared to the muscularis externa, which is actually multiple muscle layers. You have an inner circular layer, which is just part of the muscularis externa, but it's the deepest part of the muscularis externa. That's why it says inner. And it's a circular layer because that's the grain of the muscle. The grain of the muscle is circumferential. It goes in a circle around a cross-section of the tube. And therefore, when it contracts, that makes the tube smaller. All right. The longitudinal layer is superficial to that, but still part of the muscularis externa, and its grain is along the length of the tube. So when it contracts, it's able to shorten the tube or relax and let it go back into a longer position. So the muscularis externa, which includes most of the smooth muscle in terms of bulk, is what's important for movement or propulsion of the contents of the alimentary canal through that canal, including peristalsis. Peristalsis is muscular waves of contraction that move the contents through the tube. And it occurs not just in the small intestines, but also in the esophagus, right? Which is why, if you really want to, you can stand on your head and drink. That water is still going to go against gravity to get you to your stomach because the muscles of peristalsis are going to move it along. Now, the outermost layer, the most superficial of these four layers, actually has two different names depending on where you are in the canal. Where this is cut, it's called serosa. And most of it is serosa, starting with the very end of the esophagus, and then almost all the rest of the alimentary canal, that outer layer is called serosa. But the connective tissue that makes it up is slightly different for the oral cavity and most of the esophagus, and therefore it's called something different. It's called adventitia. Adventitia is less distinct as a layer, kind of just blends in with the surrounding tissues, whereas serosa is a more distinct membranous film. But they all have those four parts, mucosa, submucosa, muscularis externa, and then either serosa or adventitia. Oh, I forgot to mention the nerves here in yellow. I said earlier that the digestive system is so important that it has its own nervous system. Well, that nervous system is called the enteric nervous system. Enteric means generally of the gut. of the digestive tract. And I say it's its own nervous system because it actually has the ability to operate entirely on its own, even though it does, of course, take orders from the central nervous system. Well, central and peripheral nervous system. The peripheral nervous system connects to it, of course. It's not directly connected to the central nervous system because that's just brain and spinal cord. But what I mean by being independent is that it has sensory neurons, it has interneurons, and it has motor neurons of its own, which are the three things really that you need in order to operate as a complete complete nervous system. It's just that it usually does not operate in isolation. The main nervous system is modulating how it operates. But it's not only an independent nervous system, although it depends on which anatomist you ask as to where this is, what it belongs to. A lot of people think say that the enteric nervous system is part of the parasympathetic division of the motor nervous system, but that doesn't really make sense, especially considering that some of them are sensory neurons, which shouldn't be part of the motor neurons or the motor system. Some people just consider it its own division of the nervous system, so central nervous system, peripheral nervous system, enteric nervous system. But in any case, it's not only independent to an extent and has all the things it needs to be a complete nervous system, but it's also, there's quite a few nerves in it. There's 100 million neurons or so in the enteric nervous system, more than in the spinal cord, which is a major part of the central nervous system. So this should make sense, though, based on the importance of a digestive system in any organism, right? If you don't get energy from the environment, you're not going to be able to have anything. None of the other systems can work, right? You have to always have to have an influx of energy in the form of nutrition. So it evolved quite a complex nervous system of its own. Well, there are plexuses that make up the enteric nervous system, and a plexus is a network arrangement of things, in this case neurons. So there's the myenteric plexus that you see occurs between the circular and longitudinal layers of the muscularis externa. There's also the submucosal plexus that lies between the submucosa and the mucosa. Okay. Let's go on to the third slide. Well, we're looking at the abdominal cavity here, which is where a lot of the alimentary canal lies, of course, in terms of overall length. But that's not really the point here. The point of this slide is to show you what are called mesenteries. Now, mesenteries are connective tissue sheets that hold the abdominal organs in place, but not completely in place. They allow for a lot of movement. The small intestine and large intestine both have to undergo quite a lot of mobility, changes in shape as they propel things through the alimentary canal. So they need to be able to move around quite a bit, but they need also, importantly, not to get tangled. And so the mesenteries hold them loosely in place, allowing for a lot of movement as well. That's one function of the mesenteries. The mesenteries, though, also are major passageways for blood vessels, lymphatic vessels, and nerves going from one organ to another. Mesenteries is kind of a general word that refers to all of this sheet-looking stuff. But there are two large mesenteries that get special names, and they are examples of omenta, which is a plural of omentum. So there are two omenta, the lesser omentum and the greater omentum. And they are mesenteries. They're just special cases of mesenteries. Now, the lesser omentum, of course, is smaller. That's why it's called that. And it's just the sheet that you see here coming from the lower part of the liver down to the upper part, what's called the lesser curvature of the stomach. So in other words, the stomach hangs from the liver via the lesser omentum. Much bigger than that, though, is the greater omentum. And the greater omentum starts at the greater curvature of the stomach, which is the bottom curve, the lower edge. And then it hangs down all the way over all these abdominal organs, but in front of them all. And then it folds when it gets to the bottom. It folds inwardly and then comes back up and connects at the where the transverse colon makes its passageway from right to left. So the greater omentum isn't just one sheet. It has two thicknesses of sheets. Kind of like the old-fashioned unsanitary bathroom towels that you don't see anymore, that you have to pull out to get a fresh part of a continuous roll of cloth towel. You know what I'm talking about? Probably not nowadays, but they used to exist. Anyway, it goes like this, basically. It comes back up, so it's one large fold. And it's often nicknamed the fatty apron because it hangs like an apron in that position of the body. But it's fatty apron because a lot of the fat that gets deposited, if you take in more food than your body needs for energy, gets deposited in that greater omentum. There's two major ways to have fat in the abdominal region. One is subcutaneous fat, so that's outside of the muscle, out of the muscles, right? But another way is for that fat to be deposited in the greater omentum, and you could, of course, have both. But depending on what type of person you are, I mean, what genetics you have, it could be deposited preferentially in the greater omentum rather than subcutaneous, which means you could have quite a big belly but still see the musculature. You could still have the six-pack because that fat is deeper to the muscles. On the other hand, if you're the type of person that deposits it mostly subcutaneously, then you wouldn't see the definition of the muscles because that fat would be under your skin. Anyway, those are the omenta, and that's really the only point of that slide. Let's go on to four and take a good look at the oral cavity. The oral cavity, like I said, is the first part of the alimentary canal, and it has various boundaries. The front boundary are the lips. And what's another name for lips? Labia. That's the plural of labium, which just means lip. So there are two labia, an upper lip and a lower lip, which of course can come together. That would be the front boundary of the alimentary canal, or the oral cavity. The side boundaries are the cheeks. The bottom boundary is the tongue, the floor of the mouth, in other words. And then the roof of the mouth is the upper boundary, but the roof of the mouth actually consists of a couple parts. There is the hard palate, which is so called because it has bone underneath the soft tissue that you can feel directly. So it has a definite shape and a hardness because of what two bones or bony parts. Actually, there's four parts, but it's two different names of bones. Which two bones are involved in making up the hard palate? This goes all the way back to the beginning of 201. You have what are called the palatine processes of the maxillae, right? Which are just part of the maxilla bones. That forms most of the hard palate. But you also have bones called palatine bones. So that's the four. You have a left and a right of both of those. All four of those together make up the bony part of the hard palate, which is, of course, lined by soft tissue that you feel as the roof of your mouth if you put your tongue up there. That's toward the front two-thirds or so of the roof of the mouth is hard palate. The back one-third or so of the roof of the mouth is the soft palate. No bone involved there. So it's much softer tissue. Well, the rear of the oral cavity is called the fauces. And in that soft palate, which comes right before the fauces is just the opening to the pharynx, which is the next thing in line right after the mouth. But the soft palate includes a couple prominent arches called the palatoglossal arch first. That's the one that's more anterior. And then the palatopharyngeal arch behind it, or posterior to it. So there are two prominent folds in an arch-like position. And in between those two arches is where you find the palatine tonsils that we talked about in the lymphatic system. All right. Now you also have the prominent uvula hanging down on the bottom of the, in the back of the mouth. Uvula is a word that means grape, obviously, because it looks like a grape that's hanging there. It really is just a fleshy mass that keeps things from accidentally falling into the throat before you're intending them to fall into the throat. So what do we call swallowing? Deglutition. And swallowing of food, now liquids, of course, you just swallow immediately, but food needs to be processed in the mouth before you swallow it, including mastication, accompanied with salivation, because when you break that food into smaller chunks, you're also mixing it with saliva for a couple reasons. The saliva contains salivary amylase, which is an enzyme that starts breaking down starch immediately if it's present in the food. And coming from the tongue, lingual lipase is also a component of the saliva, and that's the one that a little bit starts breaking down fat, but not so much until after you swallow it. That's one purpose of the saliva, but also it moistens the food and holds the smaller bits that you've broken it down into by chewing it into one kind of ball that you can swallow all at once. And that ball of food is called a bolus, B-O-L-U-S. The uvula helps you form that bolus until you're ready for it to actually enter the pharynx, in which case the uvula gets pushed to the side by the bolus, by the muscles of deglutition. Of course, you also, in the mouth, have the teeth, which are the major reason you're able to undergo mastication, right? Chewing doesn't involve just the teeth, though. I mean, they do the actual tearing, shredding, and grinding of the food, but they would be much less able to do their job if it weren't for your tongue. Next time you eat, you should think about just how complex movements your tongue is doing and how amazing it is that it can not get bitten very often. Every once in a while, we do bite our tongue, and it hurts like hell. But usually we don't, without even thinking about it. The tongue is doing all kinds of movements to get that food just in the right position with respect to the teeth so that the teeth can do their job. And it just barely avoids getting bitten most of the time. I guess we better stop.